Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Meat and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is John Ratek. We'll talk to John about Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Coastal Sonoma, his other properties, and Ceritas. We'll taste the Ceritas Pinot Noir for our weekly wine sip. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Pennsylvania-born John Ratek. Worked his way through wine, eventually fueling his interest and making his way to New Zealand before making his way back to the States. John headed west, working with and at some of the best wineries and people in California before starting Ceritas, his own winery, with his wife Phoebe in Healdsburg, California. Welcome to the Grape Nation, John.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
All right, John, you have a lot going on in your life, and I need people to understand how you got here. So without taking the whole day, give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you presently to your own winery, Ceritas.
That's a great place to start. I think the background's important to us. I was born in Pennsylvania, and I grew up across the street from a hotel called the Nittany Lion Inn that was on the Penn State campus. My father ran the hotel for 23 years. And as a kid who walked to and from school, after school every day, I would walk home and I'd call my dad from the house, and he would walk me across the busy road there, and I'd hang out in the hotel. And my dad was very busy, so he enjoyed getting rid of me. And so I would do things, you know, at an early age, like peeling carrots or cutting onions or washing pots and pans. And what it did for me, though, is it really exposed me to the food and beverage industry, specifically around the kitchen. I, you know, was obviously not that interested in hotels, but had a lot of time around food. You know, I went to Penn State University. Graduated in the early the mid 90s, and went to work for some Relais and Chateau properties. First, I worked at the Inn of Little Washington, Virginia, kind of a multidisciplinary role, like around wine, purveyor management, working directly with Chef Patrick O'Connell, and it further deepened my experience around food and wine and how wine worked into the enjoyment of food at the dining table. And then soon after that, I decided that it was time for maybe a kind of a change for no particular reason. And I was hired by the Little Nell in Aspen, Colorado. At the time, Bobby Stuckey was the wine director there. Bobby kind of took me under his wing. He already had a fleet of sommeliers, but the experience I got there, you know, continued the food of, and you know, my food, learning about food, but my wine knowledge really deepened there. We tasted tons and tons of wine. Part of
what the, year is this?
This is 1998.
Okay, keep going.
And the other thing that we were exposed to there was we were also, there was, the Little Now was kind of involved in buying wines for people's private cellars. So we were tasting a lot of different wines for people's private cellars, trying to ascertain whether that was a good fit for them and or was the wine, you know, holding up with age. And so I was exposed to, you know, anywhere from 20 to 50 different bottlings a day, which as your listeners know, and people in our industry know, that the more you taste, the better you, better you get at it, and your skills are honed and sharpened, and your mind is very attuned to what's going on in the wine.
And you have the access. And not everyone has the access to taste and great stuff like that.
And tasting great stuff, as you say, the access to great stuff that you're not paying for.
Right.
So that's very important.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
So I worked with at the Now until 2000, and I moved to Australia and worked at a couple of restaurants that are now out of business there, unfortunately. And at some point, my work visa expired, and I needed to leave the country. And I was told that the most expeditious way to kind of get it renewed was to go to New Zealand, post up at the consulate, and kind of work through the paperwork with my immigration attorney. So, I was told it was going to be 5 days. Well, it was 5 weeks. And this was a kind of a pivotal moment in my life. I was in Auckland. After 3 or 4 days, I didn't find Auckland particularly interesting to keep visiting or traveling around. And somebody told me about this beautiful island off the coast of New Zealand called Waiheke Island. And I took a ferry to Waiheke Island, and it was not made known to me at the time, but it was the Waiheke Island Food and Wine Festival, which I didn't have a reservation to stay. And I was on the last ferry of the day. And I was stuck, and I met a young man who drove me out to a place called Miro Vineyard on Onatangi Bay. And I rolled up to this property, and he had informed me there was a guest house there, and I stayed at this guest house for 5 weeks. And while I was there, the Vosper family put me up. They were incredibly generous to me. And
is that the winery family?
They are the owners of Miro.
Right.
Yeah. And they had a food chef background, and they just kind of took me in, so to speak. I didn't leave the property much. They showed me a couple other wineries, other areas of the island, and they were insistent on just hosting me without charging me. And I was a little uncomfortable with that because, you know, I try to be that person who takes care of their business properly. And so I went outside one day, and Kat was pruning, and I said, "How can I help you?" Not knowing anything about pruning. And she said, "Well, you can burn the canes." And so I would huff these canes up to the top of the hill, and I'd burn them in these kind of small fires at the top of the vineyard. And slowly over the weeks, you know, she would share one more nugget of information with me, and then one other piece, and I was hooked. I loved the vineyard. I loved working out in the vineyard. And they didn't have enough work to really bring someone like me, especially a novice, online. And I went back to Australia, worked in the Yarra Valley for a master of wine. His name is Martin Williams. And it was a custom crush environment. So I saw fruit from not only the Yarra Valley, but Geelong and Macedon ranges and Coonawarra and Adelaide Hills. People were bringing fruit that far to be made because Martin was pretty well known at the time. And so I was exposed to just a tremendous amount of varietals and regions and techniques and thought processes, all the way from artisanal, handmade 1-2-barrel lots to, you know, tanks with 5,000 gallons of juice in them. So it was a real deep dive into winemaking, and it was an incredible experience. After working there, I decided that I really wanted to return to the U.S.
How much time did you put in there?
I was there for a year.
It was about a year.
9 months to a year.
And of the year, when you started pruning and schlepping the canes, what was that, a few months into it, right away? So you were working kind of the wine thing most of the time, right?
I was more on the restaurant side before that. Before. But yeah, the cane, working at the vineyard with Miro was merely just a couple weeks.
It was, okay.
Yeah. But it was...
It sounds like, like you said, it changed.
It changed. It's a point where definitely my life took a turn.
That was the moment.
That
was the period where you knew... did you know that it was wine making or wine or
I didn't know. I grew up being outside as a kid. You know, the forest, the creeks, the rivers, fly fishing with my dad. These were all part of my life. Inside was not my life. And so the being outside in the vineyard really appealed to me after having been working 60, 70 hours a week inside of a restaurant environment, putting a suit on every day and, you know, being inside of a dimly lit room. And, you know, I realized, I think at that moment, how much I missed being outside. And I also was very much intrigued to just kind of, you know, follow that thread and see where it went. I didn't really have many commitments, and I wasn't, you know, a father at the time, and
right.
I could kind of do what I wanted.
Come and go.
So, you know, when I went down to the Yarra Valley, I was exposed, like I said, to a lot of different techniques and whatnot, varietals, and I kind of learned over those 9 months that I was there, 9 months a year, that kind of what interested me and what didn't interest me. And what interested me, what caught my attention, was more of the smaller vineyard operations and also the expression of site-specific wines. And to be able to make, taste, and see a wine evolve from, you know, multiple different vineyards, let's say from either Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, was incredibly fascinating to me. And while I had been selling wine, while I had been around wine, pouring wine, tasting wine, there was no context to why.
Right.
Right.
This gave you context.
It was academic. So studying, you know, the difference between Clos de Bèze and Chambertin or Mousigny and Les Amoureux. So, to see and taste and touch and feel that was something that was very new to me. And I was very much intrigued. I decided, because of the challenges of immigration in Australia, that I wanted to move back to California and start my next steps.
So let me just ask you one thing before we get California on. Australian wine was doing very well then. I mean, they were making great wines. It was popular. They were getting recognition. And then I think they fell into a period where they lost favor, of which I think right now they're getting it back. A lot of what you're talking about is happening. Is that true? I mean, was there a time where Australia lost its mojo a little in the last 5, 8, 10 years?
You know, I think I'm not the best person to speak
just
on it.
Just from your perspective.
But you know, at the time that I was there, I felt like we were working with some cutting edge vineyards. We were exposed, you know, to a lot of these amazing wines that people revere from Australia, you know, the Bindis and,
right.
you know, Bass Phillip and Gary Farr. And we saw a lot of this fruit, and it felt like I was somewhat in a bubble at times. And then, like I said, we'd have 5,000 gallons of Sauvignon Blanc over in a tank. Right. So, you know, and those, to be honest, those didn't intrigue me so much because they felt like more wine's a process than place.
Right.
And not that they don't have their place in this world, of course, but because making 250, 300 cases of a wine from a vineyard that has meager soils and has very low yields is, let's speak honestly about it. It's just not that profitable. So,
right.
And it can be challenging at times. And, you know, but I think in terms of to your question about favor, it seemed at the time that maybe, you know, this was also the rise of Chile. You know, wines down there seemed like Malbec was taking off. And it also seemed like that the Australians and the Chileans and the South Africans were all fighting for positioning in the UK, which to me at the time, I had never visited from a professional business perspective. And so I had no idea, but that was my sense of it.
Yeah.
Today, I think there's some good friends there who are making wonderful wine, but yeah. it's definitely a struggle.
Yeah.
It's definitely a struggle to sell, you know, $40, $50, $60 wine there.
Yeah.
And abroad.
Yeah. But I do think, there's some good people making good wine, and the recognition is coming back, you know, to those guys. All right. So you leave New Zealand, you get to California. And what year is this and what happens?
So when I was in the Yarra Valley, so as you know, the harvests are opposite.
Right.
So in 2001, worked in the Yarra Valley, and Martin's roommate, college roommate from UC Davis, was a guy named Hugh Chappelle, who was the winemaker at Flowers in 2001. And he said, you should go work for Hugh. It'd be a great experience for you. And Hugh and I talked. It was not really an interview. And one of the things that I told him during our phone call about working at Flowers was that I was particularly interested in not being an intern in the traditional sense, where you kind of, maybe you lock into one aspect of winemaking, pump overs or punch downs or running the press or grape receival. And I said, I really want to only work with the Chardonnays. And I want to go to every pick and I want to sample every vineyard.
Why?
I think the way that my mind thinks is much more in the Japanese tradition of focusing on one thing over and over and over again until you get it right. And, you know,
I get that. Why not Pinot Noir? Why Chardonnay? I mean, you said somewhere down the line, and I don't know if this plays into it, Chardonnay transmits, you know, the terroir or the soil better than any grape. I mean, I don't know exactly how you said it, but is that fair or true?
Yeah, I think Chardonnay.
Did you know that then, or?
I didn't know it then.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I was 27, right?
So you,
and I was just a young man looking for answers.
So did he yield to your request? Were you able to work just Chardonnay?
He did. Yeah. So okay. And what it did for me was, and I was the only intern that was given this, I think only because I asked.
Okay.
Not because the opportunity wasn't there for somebody else. And so what I did was I was engrossed in these 20 vineyards, going to them, sampling them, watching them ripen, running the chemistry on them, and really just keeping my mouth shut and learning at the feet of Hugh Chappelle and another viticulturalist, his name's Greg Adams, who was also my boss then as well, and now he works, he's a consultant to Ceritas. So it's kind of full circle for us. But in that process, I pressed every Chardonnay, I barreled them all down, I monitored all the fermentations, and what I learned was just an incredible depth of information about clones, you know, how sugars and acidity play off of each other, the influence of new oak, from what forest, what cooper, you know, and I was just engrossed in that. I didn't
basically
even...
everything that entails what a wine tastes like after it's farmed and
exactly
vinted, right?
And I got, like you said, I got to go to those sites and I got to kick the dirt and rocks and go to every pick. And it was just this full immersion into a subject that just kind of stayed with me for a long time. I never looked at the Pinot Noir. I never even stood on the sorting table at Flowers Pinot Noir. And after harvest, so, you know, after harvest, Hugh came to me and he said, I have a job for you. It's not here, but it's down in Sebastopol. And so I went down to Sebastopol and I worked with a small crew down there. And one of the things that I got exposed to down there was a guy by the name of Kevin Harvey came to visit, and he asked if there was any young, up-and-coming winemaking, you know, people on the staff. And I was singled out, and I went down to the Santa Cruz Mountains and interviewed for a job that I really, honestly, was kind of unqualified for. But what was important was I knew the people to bring into the project. So we were in a remote location for Reese.
R-H-Y-S, Reese.
Right, exactly. And we were planting vineyards in areas that were remote. Nobody was there. There was no crews there. There was no winemaking facilities.
A lot of slope-side vineyards, right?
A lot of steep slopes.
Steep slopes, yeah.
Very steep.
Yeah.
And highly erodible soils. And so we brought in Ted Lemon to consult for a short time.
Quickly tell David, everyone who Ted is.
Ted Lemon is the owner, winemaker with his wife, Heidi, of Literai Wines, which is in Sebastopol.
And highly regarded.
Highly
at
regarded.
All levels.
And we brought in some folks from Napa, including David Abreu, to help us establish vineyards from Abreu Vineyards. And they were kind of, you know, at the forefront of hillside development, dealing with erosion control, these types of issues. And we had a biodynamic consultant by the name of Andrew Lorand. Andrew passed away 2 years ago, but he really put a lot of, he taught me a lot about biodynamic sustainable farming and focusing on the dirt and the plant health and the farm health. And he was also the consultant for Literai at the
so
time.
So up to that point, you were aware and maybe practicing, but he really solidified biodynamics and organics with you, or next level, or
yeah, we were the vineyard that we were establishing, vineyards that we were establishing. We were just kind of, I would say, we were approaching them from the soil standpoint of just boilerplate organic.
Right.
But Andrew really kind of tapped into a deeper level. And so I had this like consortium of consultants at my disposal.
Good guys. Jesus.
And it was basically like getting a couple PhDs at once. Again, kind of harkening back to our conversation.
For you.
For me.
Working side by side.
Side by side. Yeah. And working with an owner who was very, very committed to making the best wine from that area, and still is to this day. And it's admirable what's gone down there since I left. So I was there for a couple of years. I was very intense. I was a farmer.
Go back. The couple of years you were there was at the very beginning of restarting, or they were up and running a little by then?
So just at the beginning.
You were there at the beginning.
I made the first commercial
got it.
Vintage. And I think, you know, what's interesting at the time, I think most people want to see their product out there to get the recognition, but I was fully committed to just doing the job. You know,
right.
The job of establishing the vineyards, farming, doing the biodynamic practices, and learning.
But you had all these great people around you. I mean, it was sort of a joy, you know, to attempt and approach all the things you had to do.
Yeah, I felt incredibly supported. But what I guess my point is that I wasn't focused on, you know, promoting myself. I was interested in doing the work to get these vineyards established in their best way possible and to give them some legs for the future. And it didn't come without its pitfalls. It was the sites were challenging. They were rocky. They were highly erodible. We had all kinds of challenges and steepness of slopes and budwood material. But at the time it can seem like a challenge, but now looking back, it was just this intense learning experience that I was working 6-7 days a week. I was kind of isolated from the world up on the mountain, just working and kind of dragging myself to bed.
You don't mind that though?
No, I
entirely.
Don't.
You're that kind of guy. It's not like I got to get out of here.
Exactly.
It's like, this is fun. All right, so let's move a little quicker now. Get me out of Reese, which is obviously a very, very important, you know, time and point in your life, the people you worked with, you know, getting them going. What happens after that? And get me to Seritas.
So I moved to Sonoma County in 2004 after having worked for Reese since, you know, like the beginning of 2002. And I took an assistant winemaking job with Copan. And in 2005, Phoebe and I decided that we wanted to start our own winery.
Were you at Copan from then till you and Phoebe decided or anything?
I worked for Copan from 2004 to 2010.
Oh, okay.
So wow. At the same
That's
time.
That's Wells Guthrie?
Yes.
Still,
at
right?
At the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in 2005, Phoebe and I, we had this idea that we wanted to start a winery.
Just for context, when did you and Phoebe get together, started seeing each other, eventually got married? How long did you know or when?
We met in 2002.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'd been together a bunch of years. And
yeah. And we kind of saw each other on and off, but in 2003, we kind of got together. So, you know, Phoebe at the time was 25. And here I am, this, you know, brash young man, and I said, hey, I need $10,000 from you, and I'm going to put in $10,000, and we're going to start this wine label. And, you know, at the time, it just seemed kind of like nothing. But what you quickly learn is that things get real quick, and you have a business to run, you have grapes to buy, you don't realize that you need an attorney.
Are you pointing more towards the money gets burned a lot quicker? Or just everything else too.
Well, the money gets burned quickly. The wine, you know, the wine business is intensely high working capital needs.
Right, you got to be capitalized.
Yeah, and Phoebe and I, from the beginning, we just said that we are never going to take money from someone else, and we didn't want a partner, and we didn't want an investor. And the reason we said that, not that couldn't be a good option, is that we really just wanted to focus on our work without compromise and our dedication to the wines. And the other commitment we had was to only grow the company when we felt that we could sell the majority of it direct to consumer, because direct from the winery, because we felt that if we didn't do that, based upon our knowledge, based upon information that was shared with me from other winery owners, that we wouldn't last very long. And so as we
just a quick why if you know, based on the model that you wanted to go mail order direct to consumer, if you didn't do it that way, it wouldn't last. Why?
Because the area that we wanted to focus on was high-end grapes, which have a very, very high cost of entry. And if you sell that wine, let's say, all through the distribution channel.
Okay, so it's fine. It's yeah. economics and all
it's
that.
Economics.
It's the best exactly. way for you to maintain what you want to do.
Exactly. But we also didn't want to forget about my background, which was restaurants, my love of food, travel. And so our goal was always to sell, you know, the majority of it direct and the rest to restaurants. And so every time we reached this threshold point, we would grow. Phoebe and I didn't pay ourselves for 10 years.
Okay.
We maintained full-time jobs. We rolled all the profits back into the company. The goal for us from the beginning till where we are now was that at year 10, we wanted our own facility. In year 20, we wanted to own 30% of our vineyards. And at year 30, we wanted to own 50 to 60% of our land.
Where are we, closer to year 10 or past year 10?
We're at year 14.
14. So you accomplish your year 10 goal.
We built the winery at year 11.
Right, right around there.
And we've now started to acquire some land, very long-term leases with, you know, opportunities to buy them later on.
And you still want to do that? You know,
we still
14
do,
years into it, saying 20 years ago that in 20 years you want to own a chunk of the property, that's still a good plan for you?
Yeah, I think we, you know, all winemakers want control.
Of course.
Right? You want to control that raw product. It's no different than, you know, a lot of the chefs these days have farms, right, outside of their restaurant. They want to be able to control the produce that's coming into their restaurant, and we want to do the same.
So let's talk about that. So you grow wine in three different regions. Like you said, you contract to vineyards. I think it's very important who you deal with and where it is. So talk to me about that. Tell me about the areas that you're growing, what you're looking for, and, you know, who you're looking for in a partner, because that's the fruit. And you're very obsessed, you know, with what comes out of the field and the fruit. So just, you know, tell me about that quickly.
Yeah, so we predominantly grow grapes in the West Sonoma Coast area. Roughly like 80% of our grapes come from that area. And then 20% moving forward is going to come from the Santa Cruz Mountains. And what we look for is... We seek out older vines that have heirloom clones. And we also want working relationships with those vineyard owners and or leases or whatever the deal is that we strike. We basically want to get out of the field exactly what we would get out of the field if we owned it. And we only partner with people who are committed to that same goal.
Is it hard? I mean, obviously, when you make the list of what you need, you start checking the boxes, a lot of different sites drop off. I mean, are they there, or you really have to search to find those?
They're there, but it's no different, Sam, than anything in life. It's about relationships, right? You know, many of our growers we don't have contracts with, but they think of us as family.
Right. That's the best thing.
You know, they send you a gift when your children are born, or when something happens in your family that's tragic, they call you and they're thoughtful. And so, but we always, it's, you know, life is always about what getting the setup right.
Right.
You know, starting not with the necessarily the dream, but starting with the fundamentals are what's going to create a long lasting relationship where you can get what you want out of that vineyard and put into a bottle of wine. Because at the end of the day, we're making wine for you. We're making wine for the people listening to this podcast. We're, you know, and the
right.
sommeliers out in the community, they're the end critic. right? They're going to tell us if they like it or they don't. So it's, you know, our goal is to do our best work in the field, and we communicate this to our growers. And the important thing that greases this whole thing is that you have the money to pay for it. And not only do you have the money to pay for maybe if you're buying by the ton or by the acre, but that you see the relationship a little bit in like 3D, that you need to take into account their needs as well as our own. And it just doesn't help for wineries to just voice their own opinion and enforce that on a grower. I don't see growers as growers. I see them as partners. And so when we say, hey, we want all the wings removed in this block at Helenthal Vineyard today, and they say, well, that's going to cost $1,000, we write the check. We don't negotiate about it. Our end goal is to get the best fruit possible. And every year of farming requires ourselves, our interactions, our communications with those people to look at what's in front of us and determine what needs to be done to make the best quality fruit.
It's the best of all worlds for both sides.
And,
exactly. I think one of the things we didn't mention is you practice organics and biodynamics. And obviously, when you seek sites and partners, that's a critical thing, right?
Yeah, so every site, you know, is different, right? So the only site that's biodynamically farmed is Porter Bass. And then everything else is organic or sustainable.
Just so everyone knows, Porter Bass, there's somewhat of a connection. Tell me quickly what it is.
So my wife, Phoebe, she is the daughter of Sue and Dirk Porter Bass. They established a vineyard that was they reestablished a vineyard that had been abandoned in 1980 after she moved from New Jersey as a 3-4-month-old child. So we started in a good spot.
Right. Great spot.
Yeah.
She's got good hybrid there. John, we have to take a quick break. I'm talking to John Raytech. John is the proprietor of Seritas Vineyards in Healdsburg. We'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, John Raytech. John is the winemaker and co-owner with his wife, Phoebe, of Seritas Vineyards. All right, let's talk a little about the fact that, and I think you've described it, you're kind of an old soul in the sense that you're a traditional old world vigneron. You know, your practices kind of throw back to the way they do it in Europe and all of that. There's no new age crazy stuff here. Maybe a little science. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think I spent a lot of time in Europe, specifically in Burgundy and Champagne and Chablis. The thing that's most important to me is to respect the terroir and to respect the vintage. And what we have kind of tried to do over the years is to not allow production methods to get in the way of that. And use time
on. You say production in the field and in the cellar or cellar?
Mostly I'm referring to the cellar at that point.
Okay.
And we want to allow the wines just to speak for themselves. You know, our work is, you know, a week for me is like 50% in the field minimum. I see all these vineyards at least, you know, once
a week. And you're the winemaker.
And I'm the winemaker. Yeah. So,
but it's all about the fruit.
It's all about the fruit. And, you know, the winery is, you know, we may spend 3-4 full days a month there. I mean, it's just not a place that we need to be. You know, we don't tinker with the wines. We don't mess with them. So there's no point in being there other than maybe to be in your office and, you know, having an office
day.
So, you know, I'm always out in the field. And I think this is incredibly important because not only does it allow me to interact with my grower partners on a regular basis, which keeps the relationship sound and solid and checking in and face-to-face communications, which is, you know, so lacking these days with technology and everything, but it allows me to watch the grapes grow and to react, to change a course of action that maybe we thought, or maybe to get more aggressive with spray intervals with sulfur or extend them out, right, and try to eventually eliminate one. So it's that intimate time spent in the vineyard that really allows us to farm the wine out in the vineyard. And, you know, the other thing when people come to our winery, and if you come, you'll see, we have no fancy sorting equipment. And they say, well, where's your drum? Where's your sorting table and your, you know, your vibrating screen? And we, since 2006, we started field sorting all of our grapes. And what I mean by field sorting...
When you're picking out...
Well, not the day of the pick. Some people think that's what we mean. But we...
You don't even pick during the day, though.
No, we'll talk about that, yeah. But more that my stagiaires, they come to work for this, for harvest. Phoebe and myself, we go out 5-6 days before harvest, and we start cutting off fruit that has bee damage, birds, botrytis, aspergillus, things that will affect the wine that ends up in the bottle.
So you do your sorting on the vine, literally. You'll get off the vine what you don't want in the picking bucket.
And usually that takes, what that looks like is like 3 passes, actually, before harvest. So usually about a week out, we'll do a big pass to get rid of most
things. Is this a practice you saw in your past experiences, or you figured out you wanted to or needed to do it?
This is some things that I've seen in Burgundy.
Okay.
You know, that you know, people were like, what, the fruit's right in front of you. It's lit up by the sun, so you can see everything. There's nothing like looking at fruit under natural light. And so we go through this painstaking process. But what that means is the fruit comes to our winery and there's nothing to do. There's no sorting to do. There's no need to like hover over a table. And of course, that's one way to do it.
Here's a dumb question. Why don't more people do that?
I think it's kind of cost prohibitive.
It's a cost thing.
And it's also, it's logistically challenging because what most people do here kind of in the new world or California, I mean, you know, even Oregon or whatever, is that they want to slot people into roles, right? You're working, you're a field worker, you're a tractor driver, you're a truck driver. The thing that we've always done is, and this is all based upon everything that's been going on in Burgundy for a long time.
Nothing new.
That it's not, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel here, is that, you know, when I might go visit, you know, Denny Bachelet And he's like, John, just text me and I'll get off the tractor.
Right.
Right. And
they're in the field.
He's like,
they're farmers.
I'm not going to wait for you
right.
at the winery. I'll just come down in the car.
Interesting.
So what we do is when we hire people for harvest, we say, your role is every role. You will do everything. You will drive the truck. You will drive the forklift. You will go out and sample grapes. You will cut fruit off. You will, you know, go get donuts for the
which
the
is
field
what
burgers.
You wanted and did at your first internship. You didn't want to be tasked with, you know, just pump overs or one thing.
Exactly. So
you pass that along.
And so our focus is on that. And you mentioned we are very focused about the fruit coming to the winery with perfect integrity, meaning turgid berries, hard berries that are not broken, and give us an opportunity to choose to elect how we treat the fruit. And
so tell me, whole cluster mostly? Yeah. Or
so in regards to Pinot or Chardonnay?
Well, I guess you have to answer for both.
Yes.
Pinot tends to be more whole cluster, right?
Yeah, so I mean, so Chardonnay, we basically crush, we break the berries on the stem. This is a very important thing. The juice that comes out of those berries spills out over the rachis of the stem.
What's that?
The rachis is the end of the stem where the berry attaches to
okay.
the stem. And this point, the juice running over that picks up tannins, antioxidants for the juice. And
versus de-stemming, just so people know, where it doesn't have the exposure to the stem and what that can offer to the complexity of the wine, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so the fruit is loaded very quickly. It's... We pick everything at night. So usually the fruit is somewhere around 40 degrees when it gets to the winery. And we haul it in a refrigerated truck. So it's very cold. And
these are significant steps.
Yeah,
night picking only, refrigerated trucks. You know, you're going out of your way to make sure you're controlling everything.
Yeah, and we want the most efficient thing is for us to have a day that flows consistently day to day. So fruit arrives at usually 4 or 5 in the morning. We start processing at 6 or 6:30. It's a very swift process. And as soon as all the morning punchdowns, pump overs, pressing is done, we immediately go out to the vineyard and start field sorting the next block. So we're usually there by lunch in the afternoon. And, you know, we get a good 4 or 5 hours out there, and then we go back to the winery and tidy up anything. So back to the Chardonnay, this juice is pressed, goes to tank, allowed to naturally settle. We take it off its gross lees, and it goes to barrels, anywhere from 5 to 15 years old, and allowed to naturally ferment. Nothing's added to the wine.
You're a minimalist.
Yeah, I think I'm a minimalist, but I also, again, back to... I don't want anything to get in the way of what the vintage
right.
and the vineyard.
Right. I mean, minimalist is like natural wine term. I mean, it's pretty vague, but you know, you don't like to intervene as far as all that. What's funny is I see you as a guy that doesn't like to intervene, but has an eye on a lot of things like how old the barrels are and temperature and, you know, when you want to pick. I mean, that list to me seems pretty long for a guy who, and those are not interventional things. Those are just, you know, the right thing. Is that true? I mean, you have an obsession with the details.
I have an obsession with the details because I want the wines to be pure, transparent expressions. I don't want them to be marred by...
no fining, no filtering.
None of that, but then even it also just as important is microbial issues. You know,
so you're
microbial issues
clean
like...
clean bug?
Yeah, like just don't want Brett in the wine. Don't want other things, you know, that, you know, get a little geeky. You know, things like have sexy names like Pediococcus. but and we also, the barrels... the barrels are another big thing in our winery. We're, you know, when we bring new barrels into the winery, not new barrels, but new to us, used barrels, but new to Seritas, we soak them in a tartaric sulfur solution for 1 year.
Oh, really?
Before
you don't know where the hell they've been, but you
we
really
know
go.
Well, we know where they've been.
You don't know if the guy was bathing in it before he sold it to you.
Yeah, exactly.
But you really put it through your own.
And then we run a bunch of analysis on it. And this is all to, and about 20% of the barrels that we bring in, we discard. So you can imagine if we had included all those 20% that we didn't find positive attributes in would affect the wine, the taste, the smell, in a way that maybe we're not interested in.
So I guess my point about your obsession to detail, we could probably spend a show just on the barrels, and that's not even, you know. So I'm going to check off.
Would fall asleep.
Yeah, I'm going to check off the box that you're very much in tune with that. All right, let's talk a little specifically about Seritas wines. Let's get into, you know, we know where you do it, what you're doing, how you're doing it in the field and all that, but let's talk about the wines. Let's talk about how many different sites you farm, different varietals you're working with, which is not a lot. And you're starting to make a lot of bottlings, you know, so tell me, you know, what's going on there. You're working with how many sites now currently?
We work with 12 sites currently. And we make about, you know, anywhere from 3,500 to 4,000 cases a year.
All in?
All in.
Okay.
It's roughly split down the middle. That does have some vintage variation between Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and then we make one Cabernet.
Did you make Cabernet at the beginning, or you added that on?
We added Cabernet in 2012.
So fairly recently compared. Yes. Why?
You know, we never sought to make Cabernet. But we, the year before, we had made a Chardonnay from the vineyard at Peter Martin Ray. And the following year, when I was walking with Peter, you know, he said, oh, we have this Cabernet vineyard down here. And I said, oh, you know, that's nice of you to offer. But I said, we just don't make Cabernet. And he's like, no, you should come check it out. And so, you know, I went down there with him. It's not, you know, it's a few minute drive from where the Chardonnay's grown. They own quite a bit of the hillside there. And so we went down and I just saw these old vines, 100% Rixford clone, which is for many, many years, to my knowledge, was the majority clone in the Montebello at Ridge. It's changed a little bit because
they've cloned Santa Cruz, right?
Yep, Santa Cruz, notorious for making elegant, long-lasting Cabernets, a little bit different.
Would you describe yours as that? You know, because there was a period of big, unctuous, fruity, high alcohol. There's a movement towards restraint. Where do you, how do you describe
it? Yeah, I think our wine strikes a balance. It's not lean and anemic, but it's definitely has some body to it, but it's not rich and unctuous.
Right.
And a lot of that has to do with the cologne that's there.
Right.
It just doesn't lend itself to that.
So the Cabernet presented itself, you know, you're with the Martin Ray guys and he said, hey, I have this here. And,
right.
You know, you looked into it and it wasn't like, hey, Phoebe, you know, let's make a cab in a few years. The property came and it was hard to pass by, right?
It was hard to pass by. And, you know, even if you make it, nobody knows that you made it until you bottle it.
Right.
If you don't tell anybody. So it's a,
let's do the shameless plugs for a second. And I'm going to ask you at the end of the show, if people want to know more about the wines, the best place would be for them to go to the website.
That would be the best place to go.
And give me the address.
It's Seritas Wines, plural, Ceritas. winesplural.com.
And you can get more info on everything. Plus, you could sign up for the mailing list. Is there a waiting list for the mailing list?
There's not a waiting list for the mailing list. What we've decided to do about 2 years ago was we don't have a lot of wine to sell.
Right.
And so what we've done is we put together what we call a tasting membership. It's one bottle of every wine that we make. you get supporting literature to tell you about the site, tell you about the winemaking from that area. Pretty in detailed information. We put that in the box. It comes in three shipments. And then after that, we will give you an allocation. And
Ease them in there.
Well, I
don't want to press you because you're a small winery with a lot of interests. So, I mean, you have to manage it. I know you don't want to, not the word offend, but you want to be available and make everyone happy.
We do our best.
Right.
It's not easy. Like but, you know, I think that why we turn to this tasting membership, and I just want to point it out, is that, you know, we make 12 wines. It's a lot of wines.
For a small overall output.
Yeah, we have 250, 325 cases of each wine. And what my hope is with the tasting membership, and it seems to be working this way, is that people will find the two or three or four, maybe or one, that they really enjoy. And I encourage them to buy more of one that they like so that they can have one in the near term. And they can open a bottle in 5 years, maybe 10 years.
That's the way to do it.
And of course, if they want one bottle of something else, you know, then we can talk about it. But it really allows people to experience our wines over time, rather than, you know, the idea that someone's going to buy six bottles of 12 wines. That's a lot of wine.
Yeah, so, and also maybe cellar it and not drink it short term, or drink it all short term.
Right.
You want that, you know, whole kind of stage, you know, taste it early on, have it available a little later on. I think that's the way to do it.
And really bringing our customers, you know, our clients into our world, right? Because not all of them get the opportunity to travel to California,
right.
And they obviously aren't going to spend 10 hours in the car with me driving around and look at vineyards.
No.
So, it's we try to bring them out into our world and show them what's in the bottle.
The wine has become a Somme favorite, and it's at restaurants. Obviously, besides the mailing list, you make wines available to restaurants, right? I mean, you're on lists, major cities, coast to coast. I mean, tell me. The restaurant.
So we
that's important to you, right? That it's at some restaurants.
We want to be in restaurants. You know, all the wine is mostly sold to restaurants or on premise, and we're currently in 8 states.
Okay.
Here in the U.S., and one of the things that Phoebe and I wanted to do was we also wanted to distribute internationally, and we did that because, first of all, there was interest in California wines, which is great. But we also...
More now than ever, you're feeling?
More now than ever, yes. And certain countries are more interested
right.
than others. But
that is a good sign.
For us, it was... We felt like we needed to play our role, whatever that is, to show what we thought were some of the better wines from California in these foreign markets. And we're not the only ones that feel that way. And, you know, making wine, selling wine, that has its own joys and challenges, but it's really showing people what can be done in California.
Yeah.
And marketing the wines, you know, from the West Sonoma Coast and Santa Cruz Mountains, that you, like showing that you have to show them something. You
right.
can't just talk all day about it.
I think that's important.
Yeah.
We're not wrapping up right away, but we have a couple things we have to do. I have to subject you to our wine list, which is 5 questions. And we have a bottle of wine in front of us, which I want to taste and talk to you about. But we're in New York talking to John, and you were here because there's a tasting going on called West of the West, and it's basically a group of Western Sonoma growers. And the objective is, what, to introduce and show these wines, you know, to the New York consumer, press, trade, right?
Yeah, so we're going to be going to that tasting here in about an hour. And, you know, we do a seminar. We try to educate people about the region, and then give them an opportunity to taste, you know, 3, 4, or 5 wines from each winery from that region.
Right.
which again gives them a broad overview of not only the vineyards, but also people's styles to winemaking, their approaches to winemaking. And I think one of the coolest things about it is it's really principle driven. So you're going to see owners, winemakers standing behind their table, right? And not a salesperson.
Like you and Ted Lemon and all the other guys.
Andy Pei and Ken Freeman.
It's all about the Andy guys Smith on the ground.
Yeah.
Or on the ground for the tasting, which is, it's not unique, but it's not common.
Exactly.
You know.
And so we do this every other year in New York. And
by the time this airs, it'll have passed. But there's the organization has, I think, a website. It's the
West Sonoma Coast Vintners Association.
Right, and that site will tell you who are the members, tell you about it, you know, what the drive and the mission is, and of course the tasting next year. All right, John, we're going to move on. I'm going to subject you to our wine list. I got 5 questions. Don't dwell on them. All right, they're easy. First question is, what are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What's in your fridge? What's current? What are you trying? Anything intriguing you?
I think we've been drinking a lot of champagne.
Okay, that's always a great answer.
We're particularly...
You got a favorite, too?
Well, Agropart Mineral.
Okay.
I really love the wines from Jerome Prevost. And, you know, Marie Cortin.
All great stuff.
Yeah.
The Cortin stuff's a great value. Yeah. What about non-bubbly?
So non-bubbly, we've been enjoying the wines from Patloup and Chablis. We have a, you know, pretty good collection of wines from Dovasot and Ravenna, which we pull out from time to time. But as a, you know, a father of twins now, I tend to drink less. So
starting to age more.
I'm getting older.
The wines, because you can't get to them. Well, both, I guess. All right, do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? This is kind of the goofiest question on the list, but is there something that you see that you like that's just a great pairing? Doesn't mean you eat it every week, every month, but... We have a rule on the show. You can't say champagne and oysters.
Okay. Well, I wasn't going to say that.
Good.
But Phoebe and I eat roast chicken...
Twice a week.
Yeah. And I love drinking a great bottle of Pinot Noir, either from Burgundy, you know, or California with roast chicken, especially lighter Pinot Noirs.
I'm with you on that because I eat a lot of chicken. And when I looked in my cellar, I realized I have a lot of Pinot Noir. So you're ready for
the chicken.
I'm very ready. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar, place that has a good selection, good people, good knowledge? They know what they're doing. It could be by you. It could be New York. It could be in your travels. Just some. And I don't want you to be exclusive, like you left someone out or whatever. But who does it right?
I really have been enjoying the list over at Racine.
Pascaline.
Yeah, Pascaline
is a show favorite. Yeah,
Arno. They're doing a great job. I ate at Momofuku Co. last night. Their list was
great,
quite
list.
Beautiful. And Arthur's there now, kind of steering the ship, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Back where we are, I think Paul Einbund's The Morris has a
M-O-R-R-I-S?
M-O-R-R-I-S, yep.
Okay.
And he has a wonderful... depth of like vintages. It's not a big list.
Right.
It's not a small list. It's just a very smartly put together list.
All right. Those are good ones. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? I realize after asking this question so many times, maybe it's more than one. It turns out it's not always the most expensive or rare wine. It ties to an experience. Is there a wine that's a favorite or important to you, you know, not life-changing, but means something?
Well, I think it's interesting that I think probably the most life-changing wine I ever had was 78 Jantes d'Urvieux.
Okay.
It's not a bottle
I work with. Get to, you know, try that.
I have one bottle left in the cellar.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I stare at it a lot. And But I really, a wine that like always consistently delivers for it for me is Rouleau, specifically like Viroy and May Chabot.
Great wines.
And, you know, and for reds, the wines from De Monti, you know, Miton and Taipei, but that's 78 Jantes, whoa.
Yeah, that's special.
So if you're willing to sell your car, you can go get one.
Right, that's what it boils down to, a used Volkswagen or that bottle of wine. Last question, and do your best to answer this. Recommend to me the best wine around $15-$20 retail. And I always give my guests the same setup. My kids are in their 20s. They're going to dinner parties or parties. They can't bring a crappy bottle of wine for $8, $9, $10, $12, and they can't afford $35. So for $15-$20, give me a red, give me a white. It could be varietal, region, you know, you could say Muscadet. What, in your mind, what do you think are the best plays for that?
I think probably in white, it's, that's a tough question.
Just
I think you know the Thibaut Bourignon wines from Anjou.
Okay.
I think they're probably
Anjou offers some value.
Some Chenin Blanc.
Yep.
Great minerality, great terroir.
You
expression.
Think they're in that $20-ish range?
I think they're like 25.
Okay. Give me a red.
And then I would say I would go to Beaujolais.
Agree. You could do the village stuff and,
you know,
although the prices are creeping up,
they are
getting popular, but I think as a category, there's the value and there's some good makers there. Those are good ones. We tell all our listeners that we post our guest answers on our social media. So we'll post your answers on Instagram and Facebook. Before we wrap up the show, we do the weekly wine sip where we get a chance to taste some wine, and it made total sense to taste your wine. So we're tasting the 2017 Ceritas Occidental Vineyard Pinot Noir Sonoma Coast. I got to tell you, I'm on John's mailing list fairly recently. I've known about the wines and sat there and didn't pull the trigger. Realized I want these wines. So about a year after thinking about it, I got on the mailing list. And I think this is the most recent delivery, the 17. So just tell me a little more about this wine.
So we're drinking the, like you said, the 2017 Occidental Vineyard. We took over this vineyard in 2015.
This is a famous vineyard, right?
Very famous vineyard on the coast. Steve Kistler planted it around 25 years ago. It went through a number of hands, and now we have a long-term métayage agreement for this property.
Explain what métayage is.
So a métayage relationship with a vineyard is a French term, and the easiest way to say it is it's almost like sharecropping, but sharecropping with cash, not the crop itself.
Got it.
So we farm it. It's 3.5 acres. It's up on a very famous road called Taylor Lane, up above the town of Occidental. The two vineyards that are touching it are also quite famous, Thieriot and Suma.
T-H-E-R-I-O-T?
Yeah, I think it's T-H-E-I-R-I-O-T. Right.
But it's spelled different than it sounds. Yes. What was the second one?
And Suma, which is right. S-U-M-M-A.
Right. Rivers Marie and a bunch of other guys do.
William Selyem.
Selyem, right.
Made wine from there.
Right.
So we're surrounded by very pedigreed sites. This site is about 3 miles from the ocean and south facing, which is important on this road. Because as you get closer to the ocean, south facing gives you an opportunity to ripen the fruit properly. Whereas the further inland you move, you want to be, in our opinion, on the north facing slopes because it's a little bit toastier. And the soils here are a combination of blue schist and quartz. And there's a little bit of serpentine vein running through it. It's very low yielding, somewhere around 1.2 to 1.5 tons of the acre maximum. And we do everything we possibly can every year to maximize the yields. It's a challenging location because it's right in the face of the coastal influences. There's nothing protecting it.
That's why you're there. You like that exposure and that challenge. All right, let's evaluate it, though. Let's give it a little sniff and throw it over the tongue, and let's talk about it. So the color, it's not dark, but there's some depth to the color here.
Exactly.
Right? It's not a light colored Pinot Noir. It's a nice rich color, but it's not this dark brooding. So we'll start with that. How would you describe the color?
The colors, there's a lot of depth of color here.
Yep.
The clone there, Calera, about 50% of the berries don't have seeds. So you get this intense dark color. But you also at the same time have great natural acidity and great whole cluster potential.
Let's go nose first.
Yep.
You're the expert. What do we get on the nose?
So Occidental always has...
I have my notes.
Yeah.
I've had it before. Go ahead.
It's very spicy, like pencil shavings, kind of a floral element that reminds me of like roses.
I get rose petals, a little violet.
Yes,
I
wrote a little bit of violet.
What about fruit? Berries, red, dark?
Dark fruit.
Darker than redder, right?
Yeah, like, dark red raspberries. We're not getting the cranberry blood orange spectrum
here. No, you're not
getting
that crispy, crunchy red fruit, for sure.
So, blackberry.
All right, let's go mouthfeel. Definitely a medium full feel. You know, it's got nice body to it, not glycerin-y. But
right. It's the biggest wine that we make.
It is pretty big.
For us, yeah.
And in a good way. I'm not, yeah.
Of course.
So, well, I mean, the nice thing, like you said, when people go on the mailing list, they look at one bottle or something. If this is the style they like, this is the designate that offers that.
Exactly.
You know, a little bigger and all of that. All right, let's go palate. Do the nose descriptors translate to the palate? What do we get on the palate?
I think they do. We have this dark berries. You know, you get this... there's this lead pencil flavor that comes through. It's like the minerality. It's salty.
I was just going to say, I get salinity. I don't know. Is that the influence of being right on the coast, you know, or 3 miles off?
I think it's the soils and the cold environment it's growing. It's a very, very rocky site.
And you get the berries there, too. For sure, I get a little of the fruit.
Yeah, and this wine was vinified with 50% whole cluster, but you get the spice elements, but you don't get those aggressive tannins.
Right, definitely not. What would you pair? This is good with chicken, but what else is, what's a good pairing for this?
You know, once in a while, I allow myself to indulge in some, like, great Japanese fatty beef, not all the time, but
like,
you know,
kashi, like, or wagyu or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll go A5. Well with this particular wine,
or maybe the A5 goes well with it. But I think it could work well with, you know, dishes that are like heavy mushroom influence, right?
Earthy,
stewy things. I think it's a little too much for delicate fish. But
I think you could go with something else, with one of your shards or even other wines.
Like grilled mackerel.
Which has some oil and body.
Yeah.
I don't always get a chance to ask people this, but did this wine come out the way you wanted? Do you like it? Is this the expression that you were looking for?
Yes.
Because vintage is important to you. There's not a formula. We make wine every year this way. The vintage affects that. For the 17, for this vineyard, is this the wine you were looking for?
Yeah, we, 17 was a, you know, kind of a challenging vintage at the end.
Weather?
We had some warmth at the end of the year.
Heat spikes? Or?
Yeah, but and Occidental made it through that. We're happy with the wine. I think it's exactly what I expected to come from the vineyard. You know, we did tone back the whole cluster on all of our Pinot Noirs in 17. because we felt as we were sampling the vineyards that the flavors that were coming from the stems were not quite in pace with the flavors of the fruit.
So it wasn't just, it was flavors. It wasn't just that the wine would become bigger. The flavor profile wasn't going where you wanted with all the...
Yeah, when we were tasting the stems, we just felt like they were a little bit more aggressive than in years past. And so we dialed it back a little bit. Typically, this wine's getting somewhere around 70%.
So one last thing on this wine. You said it's one of the bigger wines. Is that this vintage or the Occidental, as one of your showings, is always going to be a darker, bigger wine?
I think it's going to be darker and almost every year because of these microscopic berries.
Got it.
With, you know, high color intensity.
Which shows the diversity of, you know, your bottlings and the difference in the vineyards. John, we got to wrap up. Spent over an hour here in New York. A nice Wednesday morning in New York. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at The Grape Nation. That's sam@thegrapenation.com, sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. You could subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. As I said earlier, we'll post John's wine list answers. There's some good recos in there. I will post the weekly wine sip. I'll tell you exactly what we drank. And John, I asked you earlier, but let's tell people again, if we want to find Seritas, more information, or social media, where can we go?
I just go to the website. I'm
okay.
My social media presence
we
is
we talked
lacking.
About that earlier. He's a bit of a Luddite, but that's okay. I may be able to change him a little. All right, I want to thank our guest, John Raytech. John is the co-owner and winemaker at Seritas Winery in Healdsburg, California. Thanks to our engineers and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.